Welcome back to Hash Rate Up. Today is all about Luxor. As you can see, I'm back in my usual recording environment. We spent about a month in Madeira with Bitcoin Atlantis and had some family time afterwards. Unfortunately, my plans suffered a little bit through my being away and me not really having a green thumb. With Ethan Verrett today on the show, I talked about Luxor's hash rate futures that was newly announced, the industry in general, their pool, and much more. Have a good time and enjoy. Stay tuned. All right. So like I said in the introduction, I'm here with my good friend Ethan Verrett of Luxor, COO over there. We just started, Ethan, with how was your weekend? How was yours so far?
Football, barbecue, living the good Latin American life, so can't complain.
Nice. And now you're at the office. You just told me you were in the office on a Sunday. What made that happen?
We recently set up an office here in Uruguay, part of our efforts to better support the region too. Just excited about some of the growth going across Paraguay, Argentina, so been spending a bit more time down in Latin America.
Uruguay, you said?
Yeah, our office is in Montevideo, which is, I guess, is a good central hub for, travel distance to Argentina and Paraguay.
Okay, nice. How much mining is going on in Uruguay right now compared to maybe Paraguay, to give people an idea?
Uruguay is very small. Our understanding is that the majority of energy producers can sell power into the grid for around 7 cents a kilowatt hour. And so there's not as much incentive for miners to set up shop. Now, there might be a couple unique power situations. The most notable one is Tether Mining, which very publicly has a mining farm in Uruguay. But outside of Tether, we haven't heard of any other announcements in Uruguay.
How much do they have running?
I want to say like between 20 to 40 megawatts. I can't remember the exact number, but something in that scale. It actually recently appeared in local news here too. So it's starting to make its rounds.
And I'm just going to keep you asking you questions about Uruguay. We didn't plan to go here, but it's fascinating. Uruguay, 7 cents. Why 7 cents? Why is that is that the floor for electricity price?
So I guess maybe taking a step back, when we look at, energy production in the region, the areas that are attractive to miners usually have a large amount of production, maybe a smaller population, but regardless, a very large surplus of energy. And so when you look across Latin America, there's really only a few countries that kind of fit that bill. You have Paraguay, which consumes, only a few gigawatts worth of power, but produces multiple times that. You have Argentina that has lots of stranded power in kind of western Patagonia and down south near Ushuaia, as well as a lot of natural gas up north. And then you have Chile, which is very interesting, but hasn't had a lot of mining there yet to date. Outside of those three, we don't see a ton of mining activity. The only, I guess, notable exception would be Venezuela, which is its own beast and comes with its own concerns. But those are really kind of the three future mining hubs in South America for the reason of surplus energy.
There was an article, I forgot who it was by, but it was talking about, like, a mainstream media article talking about the migration of lower efficiency ASICs to countries like Ethiopia and Paraguay. And Venezuela is probably also one of those spots. But as you said, it comes with its own merits and risk. I'm forgetting my manners here, Ethan, though. And especially today that you're on the show, we should not forget to quickly announce the block height at which we're recording, which is 836155. We are at 30-day exahashes. Let me check. See, this is what happens when I don't prepare. Nearly 600 exahashes, and then the Luxor hash price is at $100 per petahash per day right now. So halving tomorrow would be slightly above 50. What are your thoughts? Where are we going to go, Ethan, in about a month?
I think the story here is relentless hash rate growth and largely fueled by new generation machines hitting markets in large amounts, S21s, T21s namely, but microBT following up. and likely the manufacturers themselves plugging in a lot of machines. We all know of some public Bitmain joint ventures, and definitely Canaan has, publicly released a large amount of self-mining, but I think that's going to be common moving forward is the manufacturers mining as well. So that's really the story here is relentless hash rate growth. We're going to be heading into the halving probably, north of 650 exahash, maybe 700 at this
You
pace.
think so? In 30 days? Another
It depends
50?
which measure you're looking at. So the 30-day measure, probably not, but certainly a lot of T21s, S21s are being delivered throughout the course of March, like end of March, early April. It could add, double digit exahash before then.
How
So
much
we'll see.
market insight can you really sort of derive from the all the insight that you have with Luxa and the RFQ desk and the data analysis to pool the firmware that you run and stuff like we're going to get all into that because I want to do a bit of a brief and not brief but broad overview over all the products that you guys have and maybe focus on the most recent development but first how much insight do you think you guys really have? How accurate can you get with any sort of forecasts with the data you have available?
Yeah, I think generally we do sit in a pretty privileged situation where we are at the, a good intersection of information flow when it comes to certain key metrics such as hash rate growth, machine turnover, and so on. But we definitely don't sit in the best position. The best would be somebody like Bitmain, I think, would have the best view. So a more limited view than Bitmain, but a better view than majority of other kind of mining companies in the space. And then, drilling down into that, I think we have better views in certain markets, certain regards than others. For example, we are very centered around North America. We have really good information flow of machines moving within US and Canada. We have very bad visibility into other regions, some other regions of the world, such as Russia, Kazakhstan, Iran, places that we don't do business in. So we do lack some of the key elements of a global market and have to make, assumptions to extrapolate what we know and try to take, that forward with markets that we have less visibility into.
Why do you think that is? I mean, I see VRBTC as a sort of more Russian oriented or Eastern European oriented pool reaching out all over the place as well into Western miners. But why do you think there is this divide in the world? Like when we're all just doing the same thing, plugging in machines into power and then hashing, why do you think there is this almost cultural divide between mining and information flow across different parts of the world? Why do you think that is?
Yeah. Well, first and foremost, it's like a regulation. We don't do business with Russian entities or Iranian or North Korean for that matter. So there's just less opportunities for us to speak with those miners. I mean, if I come across one at a conference, I'd love to learn more about the landscape in Russia, but we're not having, weekly calls with our clients in Russia because, we don't have any. And so companies like VBTC will just have way better insights into that market because they spend more time there. But second really is boots on the ground. We started as a US-based company. For the first 3 years, we really wanted to do more business in China, which at the time was the majority of the industry. And we just couldn't penetrate the market, no matter how hard we tried. We finally got our first full-time hire in late summer 2021. And that really changed everything for us. Since that time, we've built up the amount of people that we have on the team in China and then also, from Chinese background. And that's considerably helped us get an understanding of that market. So areas like Kazakhstan that we can do business with, I think for us, we're weak in it because we don't have anyone based in Kazakhstan. And so we don't have that kind of boots on the ground knowledge. And we're reading the same news and information that everybody else is reading, which is often, misleading or missing nuance.
What does the team in the Asian regions do for you guys mainly? What's their job description mostly?
Yeah, we have an engineering team across Eastern Asia, but in this regard, I'm talking about business development, so ASIC trading, firmware, and mining pool.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, no, I just always found it fascinating. You do all the same things, but then it's really, and most people that have on the show are also, you know, European or American or from Africa. And I'm hoping that, you know, that information flow will keep, you know, keep going. Because as you said, it's such a black box. You don't know what's going on over there. I know Bitmain is heavily going into Ethiopia as well. To your point of hash rate growth, right? I think that's going to be the sort of the next growth area. It's going to take, I think, a bit more finesse overall in Africa to set up these projects. And I think hash rate growth is going to be slower as a result of that. But volume wise, there's just so much that can be done. And I don't know, like maybe on the lower measures, lower averages, but on the 30-day, I don't think we're going to keep up. And my opinion, as it stands, is that hash price is going to keep increasing. I think we're going to go to 55, 60, 70, because price is just going to keep outpacing hash rate, right? Because just maybe to break it down real simple, hash rate going up means difficulty going up, but the difficulty going up by the same factor as before now takes more hash rate in comparison because there's already more existing, right? And with each exahash coming new online, it gets more difficult to increase that number again because you need to find that power again. How much power does that translate to, do you think? If we go past 650, maybe on the way to 700 with the efficiency that we see, how many, do you know off the top of your head, how many megawatts that would be?
Yeah, I guess you're assuming an efficiency. So, I mean, roughly right now we're seeing somewhere between like 35 to 40 petahash per megawatt now of, you know, new generation equipment. So, you know, it's a considerable amount. Like that's, you know, gigawatt plus worth of energy once you start, you know, at thinking about adding, you know, that many, a few dozen exahash worth of network.
Yeah, that's a lot. And then you look at Ethiopia, and I've said this on the show before, and you've got one hydro dam with 5 gigawatts of stranded power. And there's a lot of potential there. Ethan, let's maybe take one step back. Where did you start? I know I'm posting this content on Swan's YouTube channel, right? So there's a lot of people who don't really dabble in mining yet, and they might click on this and wonder who Ethan Vera of Luxor is. Can you just give maybe 2 minutes brief background about yourself and what your role is at your company?
Yeah, so I got started in Bitcoin mining kind of twofold. One, on the institutional side, I was working at Goldman on the M&A team, started working on some of the early coverage for Goldman of blockchain. This is, you know, starting in like summer 2017, got a glimpse of it, and then really started full time in 2018 when I became an analyst there. So worked on some of the initial IPO attempts in the Bitcoin mining manufacturing space for ASICs. And then at the same time, my friend and now co-founder Eddie approached me with the idea of Luxor as a mining pool. This is kind of late 2017. And so kind of saw it from two angles, the institutional coverage side, and then also the startup side, in which we were still kind of finishing up our last semester of college. So fast forward 6 years to the present. I run our operations, finance, business, marketing teams at Luxor. So we cover a wide range of software and financial services for miners. And I basically, well, keep the lights on in a glorified way, I guess, to make sure all those products get to market and are operating correctly.
Yeah, I mean, you started with a pool and now you guys have got a lot more going on, right? What was the second product you developed past the pool and why?
Yeah. So our second, like, I guess, like product that came to market that we actually monetized was ASIC trading. We launched it in August 2021. So it was quite some time after founding the company, close to 4 years. For the first 4 years, we were running a wide variety of pools, Bitcoin being the primary, but a suite of altcoin mining pools as well. And so, yeah, the ASIC trading was a natural business for us. We were facing an environment of compressed pool fees, which I think you've talked about on your show before, but then realizing, wait a second, we sit at the center of, you know, a pretty good base of users that want all these additional services in mining, and we can help service them. So we figured it was a natural way to launch things like the ASIC trading desk that we did in August of that year, and kind of bolt that on to the mining pool. And so since then, we've, you know, followed up with a few more products, but that was kind of the decision there.
We're going to talk about the pool and the race to zero again just now, and to maybe see what your vision is around why, you know, at zero pool fees, you guys are still in a binding pool that people decide on. But when you look at the RFQ, the ASIC trading desks, since I do a little bit of ASIC brokerage myself, I always wonder, isn't it the same game, right? Isn't it the same game of trying to pay as few people's margin as possible to keep the price down? And how do you guys manage that, right? How do you guys compete with people going direct to other Asian players that are also present at all these events and stuff like that?
Yeah. So we kind of changed the terminology. When we first started, we were labeling it as a brokerage, which that's like the common term in the industry, is an ASIC broker. Since then, we've kind of viewed it a bit differently, and we've labeled it differently as such, as an ASIC trading desk. Really, we see ourselves as a trader of ASICs. We are buying and selling ASICs all day. We do roughly 500,000 in volume per day, about 170 million in 2023 worth of ASICs bought and sold. And so when we look at participants in the market, some of the most active counterparties to us are other brokers, in our sense, other trading desks, right? They constantly have buy and sell liquidity. And so we're kind of, our goal is to, like, how do we source the best liquidity on both the bid and the ask side, and basically expand our network of both buyers and sellers. And so we have a 7-person ASIC trading team today that basically interfaces a wide range of market participants, everything from miners to other brokers to, you know, hosting providers, manufacturers, and basically tries to find ways to make as much of, you know, as many trades as possible. Everybody wants to be able to transact quickly. If they're coming to market with machines that they want to sell, they want to be able to sell them quickly at a good price. And so it's like, how do we become a good counterparty for them to come to and say, yeah, we'll buy them off you, or we'll sell you them, and get them a good price and good speed.
What drives, I mean, supply is fairly easy to figure out, right? You get the suppliers, you get people who have used machines that they want to sell now before the halving, the M30s, the S19s, whatever. How do you identify the buyers? Do they come to you, or is this a pull or a push?
Yeah, I think, like with all of our business lines, initially it was like 100% a push, which is kind of like, what do you do when you start up a business? But over time, as you build, you know, reputation, network in the space, you start to get more and more inbounds, which is nice, right? As like an entrepreneur, that's the best thing that can happen, is when people come to you for your product. You feel very grateful for that. And now today, because we've been running this desk for so long, I think it's still a mix. So we do kind of reach out to some of our known buyers and kind of offer them, hey, this is what we have in the market, this is what we're seeing. At the same time, we have a lot of people come to us and ask us for machines, whether that's other brokers or, you know, miners themselves, like a lot of inbound.
What are you seeing right now? What are people selling and buying?
I think the majority of flow, like in Q1 this year, has been new generation machines, you know, north, or well, I guess let's say like better than 22, 23 joules per terahash. Like, that's where the focus is around K Pros, you know, maybe XP isn't, definitely the 21 series. I think a large part of the market demand for machines is what the public markets are valuing, and that will dictate machine flow. For example, right now, sell side research analysts covering the large publicly listed companies, they're really focused on the metric of fleet wide efficiency and cost to mine one Bitcoin. You see it in almost every one of their reports, you know, HD Wainwright, Cantor, all these guys. And so there's a race for these public companies to increase the efficiency of their fleet, partly because they want to heading into the halving, but partly because that's what the market sell side analysts cover them on. And they're trying to, you know, appease the market to get a high valuation. So what we saw is just like a massive demand of those new generation machines, kind of as people race to that. And that does present opportunities for, you know, maybe privately listed players who don't have that same incentive mechanism to actually go focus on ROI and, investment return of this machine from a cash flow basis. Buying an S19 at $4 a terahash, a 95T, could be a much better return profile than buying an S21 at,
Absolutely.
22.
I have been a big fan, and it's if you think about it, it's a very simple metric in hindsight, just dividing the efficiency of the miner, or dividing the price by the efficiency of the miner to get a bit of a profile of where the buck is best spent, and including that metric as well. And yeah, I mean, M30S is at whatever, $3 used or even cheaper used, because somebody's pressured to sell them, are a really good deal if you have got a sort of more higher risk power source to plug them into, which is again why I think that Ethiopia is about to really take off. And I've been said I looked back at my notes. I've been selling Ethiopia in July 1st, BTC Prague 2023 was the first time I spoke to people about it. I was like, hey, you need to get your foot in the door. And now a couple of months later, not to pat myself on my shoulder too much, the Ethiopian Sovereign Wealth Fund is investing 250 million or whatever. Yeah, it's crazy. Are you seeing people buying used machines as well, or is that not something you guys focus on too much, or is that not a share of your overall volume too much, should I say?
Historically, it's been a big share. I would say so far in Q1, it's been lower than normal, just as people are focusing on new generation machines. But I expect a full reversal of that after the halving, which you've identified. Not only because of the decrease of economics, but also just because of rack space. If you look at a lot of the large publicly listed companies that have announced, 50 to 100,000 machine purchase orders from Bitmain or MicroBT, they don't have all of that rack space to leave all their existing machines plugged in and plug these new ones in, which means they're going to be replacing a lot of their older generation machines. Anything north of 30 joules per terahash, like the S19 vanilla or the M30Ss, those are likely going to be unplugged by all the big public miners that have these large public, machine purchases. So we're positioned with a few of them already working on plans to sell.
Do you think it's a mistake to say, hey, we got all these analysts that are watching us and all of our publicly listed data, or monthly reports, and then now we need to make decisions based on top of that? I feel like that's the next thing along with AI, which I haven't fully understood 100%, but it just feels to me like there's a lot of short-term thinking around the market price for these publicly listed miners, and it's gonna come back to bite them in the ass over the mid to long term. I don't know why. Do you share that concern? Would you phrase it differently? What do you think?
So I would say that I used to share that concern. And I think for a long time, people have looked at the games that the public miners have been playing and have been critical of it. For a long time, the only metric people cared about in public markets were hash rate growth, and future revenue. And so there were a few public companies that took the more diligent or I guess thoughtful approach to ASIC procurement, and we're really focused on investment returns rather than hash rate at all costs. And they were not received well by the market. In fact, they're in some ways punished. And so the companies that did prioritize hash rate growth when the market demanded it ended up becoming the billion-dollar market caps, the Marathons, the Riots, the CleanSparks of the world. Because they went with what the market wanted and public investors voted on. I think there's a couple companies that really dictate what the market and sell side analysts and everyone else focuses on. People like Marathon, have like an oversized view, I guess, that's taken by the market and kind of pull for it. So now with Marathon going more vertically integrated, they're pushing narratives that they want onto the market. First was hash rate growth. Then was efficiency of machines, which obviously they're very good at, and now eventually will be cost to mine, which going vertically integrated will help them with. So there's other companies who don't really control the narrative as much, and they're kind of along for the ride. And there, unfortunately, it's harder for them to raise capital, harder for them to expand, and they've suffered as a result of it. So while I agree with you that, in a hypothetical, like in a good world, miners would care a lot about investment return, and they'd actually report on it. Okay, we bought a machine for X amount and it's returned us this much capital. It's just not what the market's playing at right now. So as an executive of one of these companies, you have to kind of oblige what these shareholders want and use it as a way to grow your company.
Yeah, but I mean, if you look at the ETFs, I think that's a development also, is that there's going to be steady outflow out of miners into these ETFs because it's just easier to allocate to when you want to have exposure to the underlying BTC, right? So I think that over the short term or midterm, these public miners will have to just try to be good businesses instead of look at what short term is important to shareholders. Ethan, let's speak about pools briefly to finish this off. I had asked you or alluded at the question, bottom race to the bottom on fees, right? It always is. Somebody's at some point gonna offer zero fees. I don't know if that already exists or not. And then it's all about the question, how do you attract miners to your pool if you don't have the revenue coming from those pool fees? What are your thoughts around that? And has Luxor thought that far into the future yet, where you don't, I think, offer 2%, but 0%?
Yeah, I've been doing pool business development, I guess, for 6 years. In that time, some weeks in those early days, I was pitching 10 to 15 companies a week. Now today I don't pitch that many, maybe a couple of weeks. So in the past 6 years, I think I've talked in almost to 1,000 companies on pitching them onto the pool. Now I would say for the criteria of what makes a successful pool pitch, there's really kind of a few different buckets, and maybe in order of importance, I would label them as consistency of payouts, which comes down to your payment methodology. Profitability of the pool, which comes down to mining pool fee, which we can get into a second because that's actually going to change. Third would be counterparty, who you're doing business with. Fourth is feature set, and fifth is ideology. And so when you look at, any type of place to gather a significant amount of hash rate onto a new mining pool, you need to focus on the first and the second point. First point being payment methodology, consistency of payouts, and second being maximizing profits. Any other strategy that's taken might be interesting for certain players in the market, but it'll never gather significant amounts of market share. So I know you talked a lot about like Ocean Pool on your show. Very interesting project. I'm very supportive of new pools coming in. I would say where I think that they're missing the mark is that they need to be looking to maximize profit for their users. They're already exposing them to variable payouts through their payment mechanism, which for simplicity, let's call PPLNS. It's found on actual blocks. I know it's labeled differently, but it doesn't, take out that variableness for miners. And so they really need to be focusing on maximizing payouts. And so like digging into those, I think, on the mining pool fee side, what it comes down to is miners want to make the most amount of profit as possible. And that's usually what drives miners. Historically, because there's been nothing interesting to do with block space, the only way to maximize profits for miners is to lower your pool fee, because everyone's getting paid the same amount for mining. And so it comes down to, who can offer me the lowest fee. In the future, as we start to see more applications being built on Bitcoin, which we're starting to see now, there's going to be additional ways to monetize block space. Those additional ways are going to heavily outweigh the difference in pool fees. So, for example, if one pool is charging 50 basis points, another 30, that difference of 20 basis points is going to be quickly outweighed by how to monetize a block effectively, include special things in that block to get extra reward out of it. So, I think where our head's at is long term, we want to find ways to maximize profit for our users, and that's going to be the way to continuously attract a good amount of market share.
Can I interrupt you there quickly? Between ordinals and just regular transactions, what other factors are there for maximizing pool revenue?
Yeah. So some of this is theoretical. Maybe I'll start theoretical and then we can get more practical. So I think a good theoretical base to start at is looking at Ethereum before the merge. Ethereum before the merge had significant amounts of what's called like MEV, minor extractable value. There was a lot of applications built on Ethereum being the L1, many of which required special ordering of transactions within the block in order to maximize returns. Maybe it was trading strategies such as front running or sandwiching attacks or others. But basically, there's a system in which traders, depending on where they could get their transaction in the block, would pay. They'd make a lot of money from it, so they'd end up paying the miners a lot from it. I remember we mined a block once that was about 100x transaction fees from the block reward. So I think that's theoretically where it could go on the high end, assuming that all these applications and keep getting built on Bitcoin. For now, I think that's still in its infancy. There's not a lot of MEV on Bitcoin today, but I think it's starting to develop. You're starting to see some forms of it, and some pools are trying to embrace it and be a part of it.
There was this concern, Ethan, and I'd love to hear your thoughts around this. I think it was Bob Burnett who put it on Twitter, and let me try and get it together correctly. I think he was saying that Marathon, with their new feature taking payments for Bitcoin transactions and including them in their own pool or in their own blocks that they mine, takes it skews the FPPS model and the revenue for it, because all of a sudden now the pool fees or the fees for that are being shared across all the blocks are less than what they usually would be. Do you think that that is a concern? How does Luxor handle the fact that maybe over the last, I think you use one day, 144 blocks, the average fees paid and your calculations on payouts based around that is not accurate anymore because of that. Have you guys put any thinking into that?
A lot of thinking. And for many years we've thought about this, which was also prevalent in Ethereum. So I think the heart of the issue right now is when there's out of band transaction fees that are not included as a normal TX fee, and that you can't see via, mempool and then eventually onto the blockchain. It makes calculating a full paper share very difficult. In the case that people are doing private mempools and they're including, okay, this is a special block. I'm putting French Montana's, new music video onto the blockchain through this inscription. I think that's what Marathon did in one of the cases. But I'm including the transaction fee publicly. That's fine. The current FPPS calculations that Luxor and the other FPPS-based pools do will pick it up, and it won't be any difference. The problem really is when the payment is made outside of the blockchain. Maybe they get paid directly in a USD wire transfer, and they just set the transaction fees on the blockchain to zero. And then now we're working with limited visibility. So I think if this becomes, a material part of the network, which I'm not sure it will be, but in the case it does, I think, FPPS pools will have to adapt their methodologies. Maybe it'll look more like what Ethereum moved to, which is PPS plus, where basically miners are getting paid out the expected value of the block subsidy, but the transaction fees are done on an actual block basis. So Luxor mines, let's say for simplicity, one block with one BTC that day in that block, we divvy up that one BTC and TX fees to the miners, something like
But I
that.
mean, would it not be similar to just saying, hey, let's look at the last 144 blocks or increase it to 150, but exclude all the ones that Marapool mined? Is that not an option?
Yeah, I mean that would solve for it in this particular case for sure. I think as we think through payment methodologies, you want to find a way to create a payment methodology that will at least last like a couple of years. It's very painful sometimes. Of course, we have like SLAs, contracts. We've walked auditors through our payment methodology. I've talked to every one of the big four accounting firms on how FPPS works. We don't want to be like changing it too much, but certainly I think there's ways that you could get smart on excluding certain blocks. For simplicity, assuming a block is zero, you could just say, okay, we're going to ignore that block from the calculation. We're not going to use it as part of our average.
Why? Okay, yeah. Why are the big four interested on as to why to understand how FPPS works?
Yeah, well, their clients are the large Bitcoin miners
The large
in North
miners.
America,
Okay.
and so large miner A will reach out to me and say, hey, you have to go talk to our accountant. They don't understand FPPS. They've never spent any time in Bitcoin. Okay, why don't you go educate them? So
How fun.
it's not. I wouldn't say it's the best part of my job, but it's an important one.
I hope they pay you for it, though. Okay, so what about steps 3, 4, and 5 in the pitch?
Yeah, so three, four, five, I guess, are definitely secondary considerations. Counterparty, who you're doing business with. I think pools, fortunately, because the payment intervals are usually so short, usually 24 hours. We do up to every hour miners want, but most miners do 24. Your counterparty exposure risk isn't the same as it would be for, say, a BlockFi or one of these platforms where you're putting your long-term capital into. So for the
Yeah.
pool, if a pool misses your payout after 24 hours, you probably message them, hey, why'd you miss this payout? Maybe you let it slide to 48 hours, but after 48, like any miner would realize, hey, I'm not getting paid out by my pool. I need to quickly switch my miners. So there is some counterparty risk on the fund side, but it's minimal. Other counterparty risk is just like on the compliance side. And that's more true for some miners than others. I think some miners and jurisdictions have kind of a full menu of pools they can choose from. Some miners probably wouldn't. I don't think a large publicly listed mining company would work with a BTC, for example. Then there's things like, SOC 2, Type 2 that kind of fall in that loose bucket of, can I trust this company with my data and privacy and security? Fourth would be features. I mean, we just have constant stream of miners requesting different features, payment splits, operating dashboards, all these things that you got to build tooling for. All very cool and really add value to miners. It's helpful for miners, but it's not like the reason you win a pitch is not because you have that feature in your dashboard. It's a reason you might maintain them versus another pool.
When I spoke to Mehdi, it seemed to be like one of the core features, right? Is fleet management along with energy market controls, like around and what controlling your farm around what happens on the energy markets and triggering different things and integrating that with your pool as well. I know Brains is heavily focused on a combination between firmware and their pool. You guys also have your own firmware. So I think it's going to become more important, and I kind of foresee a future where there is a pool, especially for miners in Africa, or that sort of bands the communities together or adds values somewhere else that I haven't thought about yet. But I think it's not just it can't just be hey, I'm the biggest miner. I've seen even mining pools who focus on buy host providers, who say, hey, if you mine with us, we'll put the pool fee to zero and you will get dashboards for your clients to look at that are nice and pretty so you don't have to develop them, right? Stuff like that where you look at different participants in the market and try to solve problems for them. But yeah, I mean, using Luxor Pool, I'm a fan, you know that. I like the overview. I like the watch links that you get. I think that's a standard feature as well. The roles, I think you've added where you can give different roles to different folks and different access. That just makes it very easy to mine on. Yeah, but again, I would love to hear your pitch today. We don't have to do that now, but I would love to hear your pitch today versus your pitch in 5 years, when it's about attracting hash rate. Maybe we can revisit that.
Yeah, I'll put it in the calendar. And just,
Yeah,
a quick note on that point. I'm
please.
not happy that features is so low on the priority list because I also think, our features are, top quartile. Medi has a great platform too. And some other pools do. I think we've put a lot of work. We're on 5.5 now, so we've done 5.5 iterations of our pool dashboard over the years, mostly with user feedback. That's almost once per year. We revamp the entire platform with additional feature set. But then you go to the top pools, which is Ant Pool and Foundry. If you log into the Ant Pool dashboard, it's pretty rudimentary. Foundry has got, a nice aesthetic, but it's not that robust of a feature set yet. They dominate the industry. And so, yeah, a lot of this priority
But
list,
why is
like
that?
I agree
Why
with
is that? Just being first and having
FPPS,
legions.
low fees, FPPS and low fees. They came in, offered the
Yeah.
lowest fees at FPPS, and you could have the
What are they
nicest
at?
dashboard in the world. Last time I checked, like 170 exahash.
And how many fees? How much fees do they charge?
When they came into the industry, they offered 0% fees, which is how they accumulated all of their hash rate, part of the reason, but the primary one. And then since then, they've, I think, increased it. Like, I think large institutional miners get, somewhere between 30 to 50 basis points is my understanding. So their pool fees are actually on the rise.
All volume. I know Phoenix, the Phoenix Group from the UAE, also started their own pool, I think. Yeah, there's another interesting one I need to speak to. Ethan, let's wrap pools up. Before we run out of time, you recently came out with another announcement around hash rate futures and hash rate derivatives. Do you want to give people a brief breakdown? I've done many shows on this back when it was audio only around the different players that offer hash rate futures in some variety. Maybe give people a small background on what they are, why they're useful, and then we can talk about your NDF and now the recent announcement.
Yeah, so I think just generally, hash rate derivatives, what they're trying to solve is twofold. They're trying to provide a hedging instrument for market participants that are inherently long hash price. So a good example of that is a miner. If they buy, an S19 today, they know it generates $10 in revenue for that machine today. They don't know what that machine is going to generate in a month from now, 2, 3, 4 months from now. And so they have no real certainty on the future cash flow of their investment. Adjacently, other share like stakeholders in the mining industry also have that inherently long, where if the hash price increases, they do better. If it goes down, they do worse. So like other commodity industries, we've always thought, okay, this industry needs a derivative product in which miners and market participants can hedge their future revenue, bringing more certainty to their products. And to their investment. And then on the flip side, there's, a whole set of investors, traders, family offices, that want exposure to hash price, but may not be in the best place to own the underlying, assets, being the computers and maybe even the infrastructure. That's not their expertise. Maybe it's, a prop trading shop out of Chicago with three guys sitting at their desk. They're not in the business of running large scale mining farms. So I think hash rate derivatives basically presents a product for both these types of users to hedge risk and also for people to get exposure to hash price.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, I've always framed it as transporting the risk to somebody else, right? Not having that risk and getting somebody else involved and using hash rate futures to transfer the risk from me to the buyer of that hash rate into however long into the future. You then guys came out with the Luxor NDF, non-deliverable forward or future. What was that compared to what you just said? Yeah, and why did you develop that first?
Yeah. So when we kind of thought through the derivative landscape, we didn't want to reinvent the wheel. There's derivative contracts that exist in existing commodities that serve the purpose for everything I just mentioned, mainly hedging. When you can bucket those into kind of two different buckets. One is OTC, one is exchange traded. On the OTC land, majority of those contracts are what we call like forward contracts. On the exchange side, many of which are futures and options. And so when we kind of looked at, okay, we can launch forwards, futures, options, we decided that forwards was probably the easiest lift to get out the gate. They are regulated in the US, so you have to oblige by certain regulations, such as signing ISDA agreements, reporting to an SDR. The market participants have to have minimum asset sizes. If they're trading, they have to have a 10 million asset size on their balance sheet if they're using it for hedging 1 million. So there's certainly restrictions when it comes to forwards,
10 to
but
1?
It was a much...
So, sorry, hold on. You have to have assets worth 10 million in order to participate in this?
Yes,
so,
if you are using
you need
it
to be
for...
a fairly large operation.
If you're using it for speculating. If you're using it for hedging, it's 1 million.
Okay,
so
understood.
It basically means that retail can't participate in this market, which obviously is, you know, designed for a reason from the regulator standpoint. So it limits the amount of market participants that we can have. But it was easy to get off the ground, and it really started to form the basis of hash rate trades. We were able to start creating what we call like the forward curve, basically forward pricing over the next 6 months. We launched that back in early 22, so it's been quite some time since we've been putting on those trades. We followed it up by another forward contract kind of mid to late last year. It had a slightly different mechanism, but was still a forward contract. And then the latest offering, which we announced this week, we're super pumped about, is the futures contract, which is an exchange traded product. And it took quite a bit more work, but I finally got across the finish line. So very happy about that.
Okay. On what exchange is it traded?
Yeah, so this is a hash rate futures contract that we're offering that's traded on the Bitnomial exchange. So it's a regulated DCM exchange in the US. It's a slightly different mechanism for traders than a forward contract. It's exactly like what you do when you trade on like the CME, for example. So miners or traders have to onboard what's called an FCM. Those FCMs deal with margining and basically connect to the exchange. So it's a much more regulated process with a lot more oversight from the CFTC. But you kind of move away from this counterparty being Luxor to now counterparty being FCMs, kind of TradFi roles.
So how do you keep making money on that?
Yeah, so the exchange product charges a fee. It's a dollar amount per contract, similar to like a CME Bitcoin futures or options.
Okay. All right. Interesting. All right. Because I remember, Matt Stewart, who was on Peter McCormack's show to talk about the
Matt Williams, futures. Yeah, our head of derivatives.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got his last name wrong. Sorry, Matt. Yeah. Okay. And so, but what changes? So, you know, I'm a skeptic. Ethan, what changes for me as a skeptic now that this is traded on a on an exchange rather than basically OTC via Luxor, right?
Yeah. Well, I guess let me talk about the differences and maybe the skepticism after. But the difference really is this is now centrally cleared. There's a matching engine. So a lot of probably the people that listen to this have traded on exchange before. You get to log into a dashboard. You can see like the bid and ask spreads on all the contracts. As soon as a bid and ask match, that trade is now executed. So that's kind of the main difference between a futures contract and a forward. There's additional differences such as higher standardization. Our future contracts are monthly contracts and they go out 12 months. There's no room for bespoke contracts. Everything is standardized. In some ways, they replicate a lot like electricity future contracts because of the ephemeral nature of hash rate and the consistent kind of delivery and settlement of it. So those are the key differences. But I think people really like this product for one, increased transparency. The order book is all public. And so you can always go see what hash price is trading at. And then easier to move in and out of positions. Because it's a much more wide range of market participants. And then finally, is the counterparty side. You're kind of pushing away that counterparty risk.
Yeah, it makes it a lot more smooth, I guess, as well, right? You log in, you get your offers, you get your buy and sell walls of hash rate. And how do I differentiate between, I guess I should have a look at this and maybe say again, Ethan, how people can find this if they want to have a look. And sorry if you said this already, can I, as a small time person, log in there and have a look and buy and sell? Or do I have to have a certain size still?
Yeah, so actually the range of market participants, depending on how you look at it, could actually be wider with a futures product than a forward. The futures product requires you to onboard via an FCM, which they're going to go through the regular due diligence, KYC process that you'd expect out of any kind of
Explain to
counterparty.
me what an FCM is, Ethan. Sorry,
Yeah.
for a
So
non-American person. What
futures.
is an FCM?
Yeah. So this is basically an entity that interfaces the exchange and the trader. And so the trader onboards to them and they deal with margining. So based on your financial and other profile, they'll determine how much leverage you can get trading on the exchange. And they'll be the ones to guarantee it. If you get margin called, you're getting margin called by the FCM, for example. So it's just a regulated entity that sits between traders and regulated US exchanges, not just for Bitcoin, but for every derivative contract.
All right. So, but I could go to the platform. Which platform is it? Say it again.
Binomial.
I could log in there, make an account, and I could start going after I went through the DD.
Yeah. And so part of that FCM process is funding your account. Depending on your size of trade, usually it's like a 50 to 100K minimum to fund your FCM account, depending on the FCM.
Okay.
But something in that nature. And so there's going to be a much larger range of participants. I think, miners that are in the kind of the 1 to 2 megawatt range, this is already a product that might be interesting for them. And we're starting to see a lot more miners push forward with different derivative strategies. I think mostly historically looking at it on the electricity price side, but now looking at it on the hash price side.
I mean, hell, if you have like just an idea, right? If you have S19Js in America, maybe you've got 1,000 of them, and you wanna get them into a hosting deal where somebody has some extra spare capacity on the transformer that they're not using. Okay, put them on there, and then you lock in the returns for the next 6 months at 50 or 40, and you're guaranteed to make that money, and you're giving those miners another lease at life or a second round right after they've already been ROI'd. Why, that's not a bad deal. That's great.
Yeah,
Congrats, man.
I think
That's a huge step.
one of the hidden benefits here is really reduction of cost of capital. We've seen the cost of capital for miners be significantly higher than every other industry. Miners are used to borrowing at 17 to 22% on a USD denominated basis right now. That's pretty high. So I think once you start plugging in revenue certainty and you start to say, okay, I'm going to use this debt capital to buy a machine. I've locked in my power costs. I've locked in my revenue through hash price. I'm guaranteed this return. It changes the entire profile from a lender's perspective.
I'm
And so they
familiar.
should start offering way less in terms of interest rate on that capital.
And look, this also plays into something I've said, I think on the show previously. Now, so first of all, with Bitcoin price in dollar terms going up, right now miners can afford more infrastructure payments, can afford more mining, can afford to build more, right? That's number one. Then you have that vicious cycle. Now this, when you say this, and you are a very conservative player in the energy industry, and you've got stranded renewable assets somewhere sitting around, and a miner comes to you and says, "Hey, like, can we build something together?" Now you're going to tell them, "Hey, give me a bunch of deposit money because I don't know if you're going to disappear or not." But if you can now show to say, "Hey, like, this is how I'm going to do it. This is where I'm going to lock in my revenue, and this is a financial market that I can play on, and that we can engage on together with the hash rate that we will be producing because it's a commodity." It gives it another completely different facet, a more professional facet, a more professional image, to the more conservative players that Bitcoin miners always have to interface with, right? Because on the one hand, you've got these really conservative, don't try anything new energy generators and energy and players. And on the other hand, you've got the funky Bitcoin mining people who come along and say, "Hey, we can take power anywhere and anytime. How about we set your floor price at 10?" And that's too good to be true. Get out of here. Like, what are you talking about? Give me, if you want me to build 10 million in infrastructure, give me that 10 million in collateral before you disappear. And I think it's just going to unlock a whole heap more generation, a whole heap more hash rate going up. Hash rate up is always good. And yeah, congrats, man. How much volume are you seeing on this right now? And how much are you
Yeah,
expecting?
so
What's the trajectory?
Yeah, our forward contracts, which is like the established market, our futures is going live this week. Our forward contracts, they were in January, and I guess you could extrapolate that to Q1. It was about a few exahash at any time was being used in the markets. So there's different ways that we track it, but yeah, basically like a few exahash outstanding.
Okay,
So we can
and
put on trades like 1-2 exahash on our forward markets now.
how much volume is there right now without me looking? Do you know, like, how much orders, how much buy orders is there, how much sell orders?
Yeah, so I
And
think
because this is also
outstanding.
something, I mean, I get the NDF every day, the price updates. And one thing that you notice is that the spread between the bid and the ask is always quite far. You know,
Yeah.
there's a lot of mismatch there. Does that move closer together?
Yeah. So I guess, yeah, there's two ways to measure like the traction of the market. I mean, there's volume, like actual put on trades, which is like that few exahash outstanding right now. But then two, which is really important, is liquidity, right? So if you're a miner trader and you look at the order book in the future, you want a lot of liquidity there and you want well-priced liquidity. And so right now we have about 850 petahash bid and ask up and down, basically on both buy and
Okay.
sell side, up to 6 months out on that forward contract. As you've said, the spread is pretty wide. I think, how do we tighten that spread? Well, really that's a function of more market makers coming into the space. Market makers that are willing to put liquidity onto the books. I think people are starting to get more sophisticated in how they forward value hash price, and they're starting to form better views of it. But I would say there's been a lot of long educational processes we've had with potential market makers that haven't been able to get fully comfortable with what's going to happen post-halving. But I think, once we pass that event, it's going to take out, one piece of the uncertainty. And we're going to have a few more kind of traditional crypto market makers join and put liquidity, which hopefully should push down spreads a bit so that those
Yeah.
spreads do tighten. It'd be nice to have like a few exahash bid and ask on each of those monthly contracts, within like 5-10% spread of each other. That would be a really good target for us by end of second quarter.
Ethan, we covered a lot. You're in Uruguay doing a thing. You have to come back at some point or bring somebody else from the team to discuss all the other topics that I wrote down but haven't gotten to. Is there anything that I have not asked you that you wish I had?
Well, we can riff all day. So next time we come on, we gotta talk about the updates in Africa, firmware and everything else exciting going on.
Love it. Okay, where are you going to next after Uruguay?
Going to New York tomorrow night to meet with some trading firms. So hopefully, some TradFi firms are interested in this new asset class. We do think it's like the first ever compute derivative exchange trade product. I know it is. In the US. So hopefully we can kind of approach traditional commodity trading firms that trade oil and gas and other commodities and pitch them on this idea of compute derivatives.
Are those pitches going to be in a bar, in an office, or on a rooftop?
Unfortunately, mostly in offices. But
Rooftops after. All right,
yeah,
man.
exactly. Rooftops, I'm
Last
meeting too.
question. La exactly. Last question, Ethan. Does Bitcoin consume enough electricity? Yes or no?
I mean, the market's voted and it consumes exactly as much as the market wants it to right now. But I'm bullish that that's going to be a lot more in the future. So Bitcoin price keeps increasing, then people are going to keep increasing their expenditures on infrastructure and machines, and we'll keep pumping hash rate and the use of power. But that relies on people finding value in Bitcoin, and the security budget, will follow.
Where can people find you? Where do you want to send them?
Yeah, our website's luxor.tech. So pretty simple. We have our suite of products there. You can find me on Twitter, Ethan underscore Vera. Appreciate
And
you
maybe we
having me
can.
on. It was a great combo.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Anytime. Where can people learn more about the latest announcement? Is there any sort of special page for it?
Yeah, so we have a whole section on hash rate derivatives on our website now, including a landing page for the futures contract. It goes over that onboarding process, which I know can be a bit complex and foreign to people. But we also have our introducing broker license, so we can help guide people through that process of setting up an FCM and getting them onboarded to start trading.
All right, amazing. Guys, if you learned something new, you know what to do. Thank you, Ethan, for all your time. I wish you good luck in fancy New York. I'm sure you'll have much success in pitching this, because I think also those guys need something new in their lives. You know, the energy guys need the perfect consumer in their lives, and traders need compute derivatives, I think. Next Sunday, we'll speak mining again. I don't know who to. We'll have a look. Again, if you learned something new, you know what to do. And I'll see you next time. Thank you. Bye-bye.